This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, coming to you from my home in Aberdeenshire. I was all set to give a really sort of, you know, gloom and doom. This is terrible Scottish wintertime, ice on the ground, freezing outside. But the truth of the matter is that the sun has broken through and I've actually had to close the curtains because I couldn't see the screen. To figure out what was actually happening here. So actually here, in this particular corner of Aberdeenshire, it's actually pretty good. With me in this edition, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, I'm in Banffshire. I'm about 40 miles north of you. The snow is coming lightly down. The roads are like an ice rink. I actually went out with a couple of curling stones earlier on today. And seeing the dog doing four-wheel drive skating all over the place was an absolute delight. And I'm doing kind of little granny steps to stop me falling over. But it's lovely at the moment.
Everything I do at the moment is essentially impersonating a penguin. Now, we were prompted to invite our guest today by you and the other people who either listen to our live programme on BBC Radio Scotland or download this podcast, because just before Christmas, we ran a programme focusing in on nature writing, asking for suggestions, things that people might like to get for Christmas. Umpteen folk recommended Roy Dennis's book, Cotton Grass Summer. Now, Roy is no stranger to us. We've interviewed him umpteen times over the years. But this latest collection of essays is a really fascinating insight into a long life dedicated to conservation.
From his childhood in Hampshire to working in Fair Isle and Abernethy Forest, travels across the globe, and of course his role in the major reintroductions of white-tailed sea eagles, red kites, and not to mention the pioneering work with ospreys and of course beavers. I've been there at all the major reintroductions of red kites, beavers, sea eagles, but I've just reported it. Roy actually did it. He's a true legend, and we're delighted that he joins us now from his home in Moray.
We're going to work our way, or try and work our way, through just some of the book, because I think there's 52 essays, essentially one a week, in Cotton Grass Summer. You cover all sorts of themes, including rewilding. But first, can I take you back to your childhood, growing up in Hampshire, south of England? Because you paint a very vivid picture of what life was like for you, and it seems to have been much richer in wildlife.
I think it was, although there were things missing, but it was very much a childhood of being able to wander everywhere. Our parents just let us out in the morning and then shouted at us in the evening to come in and get ready for school. So we could wander the kind of, you know, burns and the woods and the marshes and that. I suppose really starting off was things like bird nesting and collecting eggs when I would have been about 8 or 9 years old. The war had just finished, and the other thing I remember, there used to be an inordinate amount of what we call sheets of tin lying around. And if you lifted them up, then you were likely to find snakes, grass snakes, or lizards, or slowworms. So that was a great fun. And then also going into the small ponds and catching newts and collecting frog spawn and toad spawn. So we had a very wild childhood that we could wander everywhere and climb trees and all sorts of stuff. And then that moved to joining the Boy Scouts when I was 11. And I was lucky to be in a troop that was really backwards. Our hut was up in a tree and you had to climb up the tree to get in the hut. And that guided me away from things like egg collecting towards, you know, real nature study. So I was fortunate like that.
You kept a series of journals and records about your observations of wildlife for most of your life. I mean, you started out on Lundy Island looking at bird life, then at 18 you're on Fair Isle, and at 19 you're on Loch Garden. I mean, you must have been seeing stuff happen at a really, well, you say an exciting time, but possibly a depressing time.
No, I think it was a very exciting time, actually, because nature conservation had really just started to grow in the 50s. And there were some very influential people, you know, people like Peter Scott and James Fisher. And the other thing was that there were so few of us that we kind of knew everybody. And not only that, there were very few books. And whenever something was published, either in a book or a journal, we probably knew the person who had done it. So there was a wonderful kind of network of people. And people had time to mentor people like me. That's much more difficult nowadays because there are so many. I could be taken under the wing of, you know, the finest ornithologists in Scotland. And that was very important for me growing up.
We do the live programme in the car park in BBC Aberdeen. Nobody really knows why. But not terribly far away, there's a church tower. And regularly on the church tower, we see a peregrine falcon. What always astonishes me is that there's pigeons fly in all directions, seemingly either unaware of it or maybe they've got eyes in the back of the head. I don't know. They're fabulous, beautiful animals. Really remarkable to see one, you know, stoop and actually make a kill. Would you mind reading from your book, Cotton Grass Summer, page 11, the first three paragraphs? Because, I mean, this talks about a particular spot you first visited in 1960.
Yeah, and it was an important place because when I was young, the peregrine was okay. And then the pesticides came in and the peregrine population collapsed. And there were none left, really, in England. And the stronghold was in the Scottish Highlands on the moorlands. And it was up here that we had the ones which then recolonised Britain. And one of those nests I still regularly pass. And this is a couple of years ago, and I'm passing it. Today was one of those gorgeous early spring-like days of late February in the Scottish Highlands. After early morning frost, the land was sparkling under a bright blue sky, and the patches of lying snow gave Strathspey the look of Lapland. With a temperature of 10 degrees centigrade and a fresh westerly wind scudding Cottingmore clouds across the sky, it was a joy to be in the field. At midday, my route took me near a traditional but long-deserted peregrine eyrie. And suddenly, I saw a shadow high in the sky to the south. Jumping out of the car, I saw through my binoculars a male peregrine falcon throwing himself up and down in the strong winds, maybe 500 feet above an ancestral nesting cliff. His forebears would have returned here on good days in February, every year back through more than five millennia, freshly returned from the lowland wintering quarters to join their mates. He plunged to the north behind the heather hill and then flashed across the front of the crag. He braked, and I thought he was going to land on the ledge where I remember they used to nest. But no, a slight hesitation, and he threw himself upwards, gained height rapidly, and without a backward glance, headed west, high over my head. His brief visit had shown him there was no waiting female, no empty scrape, nor any distinctive white roosting ledges. The crag was abandoned.
You use a phrase in that where essentially, you say there's a shadow in the corner of the sky. I've been out with you. I'm lost in admiration, but also I find it incredibly depressing because you spot something and it's a flicker. It's a flicker of movement in the distance. And you say with absolute certainty, and I would bet the farm that you're right, what that animal is, you know, what that bird is, etc. You have an almost preternatural ability to spot things.
Yes, but that is due to starting when I was probably 8 or 9 years old, and then slowly learning more and more experiences and being guided by, you know, bird watchers when I was, say, 14 or 15. You can identify that by this. This is the kind of condition you should be looking in that direction, because that's where a golden eagle might appear. So it's not just being able to identify the bird from the colour, but also knowing where it's likely to occur, knowing at what time of the day or night it's likely to fly by, and also its shape and its jizz. It's just something that's built up. And in the end, it's just marvellous that you can identify things so easily.
If I can take you back to that paragraph you were talking about, the peregrine nest in the 1960s, what was the mood amongst yourself and fellow environmentalists when, I mean, realistically, we were on the cusp of losing our birds of prey because of DDT. You seen that as a challenge? Did you get angry? Were you fed up with it?
No, I think it was, for me, you know, I was very young. I was 20 when I climbed up that cliff first. And the second time I went up, in, I think it was April 1961, there were 3 eggs. And I noticed that one of them was leaking. It had a crack in it. And I went back later and none of them had hatched. And I collected those eggs for Derek Ratcliffe, a scientist in the Nature Conservancy. And he was the man that analysed all these eggs, found that the DDT caused the eggshell to be thinner, and that the birds were failing because of these chemicals. But getting the change that made that chemical illegal in the countryside was hard work. And, you know, it got to the stage when you started to say in your discussions with the farming lobby and agricultural ministers and others, if this is happening to the peregrine and the golden eagle because they are eating animals that have been affected by DDT, or in the case of eagles, eating dead sheep that had been dipped with DDT, why are we eating these same sheep? Now, the government never wanted to discuss that. They didn't want to give anyone, you know, the worry that we were eating contaminated food, and that chemical was banned in those conditions. Now, I think the conservation bodies, the Nature Conservancy and the like, were very strong at that time. And I wish that nowadays our conservation bodies were as capable and as bold at influencing ministers.
If I can take you back a wee bit to Capercaillie. Now, I vividly remember Mark and I were doing a live programme on a Saturday morning from a forest, I'm not going to say which one, with somebody from that forest, and made the comment about how many Capercaillie they have. And on the live programme, you came on and said, "Oh, no, you don't. You don't have any." And it was a really awkward moment, but it was a poignant moment, because you can remember when Capercaillie were thick on the ground.
Oh, completely. You know, I remember I arrived at Lochgarten in April 1960, and walking from the camp the mile through the forest to the osprey hide, some mornings I might kick up a dozen Capercaillie. Everywhere you walk, there were Capercaillie. And then in the autumn, when the stooks, when the oat stooks were in the fields of those highland crofts and small farms, the Capercaillies were thick coming out of the forest to eat the grain on the stooks. They were really plentiful, despite a surprising amount of shooting, because they were regarded as a pest rather than a game bird. And the change in Capercaillie is just frightening. Personally, I believe there's probably no more than 300 at the beginning of the spring, and I just don't believe some of the figures. And I believe the conservation of the Capercaillie is critical and needs really you know, impressive, radical management at this time.
Why is it critical?
Well, I think for us to lose a bird of such importance to Scotland, you know, it's a real, it's the iconic bird of the native pine forests. We lost it once before and people brought it back. And to lose it again would signal that Scotland and the UK were failing in their duty to look after nature. It would be a shocking example of failure. And so it is essential resident in the pine forests, and we just have to make certain we keep them. What they're doing is demonstrating the problems that we have, which we have to solve.
Something that's more of a success story is the osprey. You write about a particular bird called Green Jay, first osprey in the UK to be fitted with a satellite tag. Why was that so exciting? Why was it so relevant? What did you learn from that bird?
Green Jay, I ringed her as a chick on the Black Isle in a nest that I had constructed on the Black Isle a decade before to try to encourage them to breed in Ross-shire. And then finally they did in 1991. And I ringed that chick. And in 1995, we found that bird breeding in a nest near Carr Bridge. And she bred there year after year. And she was a very successful breeder because, you know, with ospreys and other lots of birds, you get ones which are really good at breeding and producing a lot of young, and other ones which are average, and then some which are just duffers. And Gree Jay was a special one. And in 1999 was the year when we were given permission to take some ospreys from Scotland to Rutland Water to restore a population in southern England or middle England. And the very first one we collected was from Green Jay's nest. Now, people thought that if we move ospreys like that, they wouldn't know where they went to go in Africa. And so it was agreed that we would tag some young and tag some adults in Scotland. I caught Green Jay and I put a satellite on her back. These were tiny little satellites weighing 25 grams, which had just been designed in America. And I expected her to go to Senegal. And then in the autumn, she goes down through Spain and she winters in Extremadura. She never went to Africa. And she continued to breed, and then I caught her and took the radio away because the battery had run out. And she produced many young, some of which were translocated to Rutland, some to Andalusia, and some to the Basque Country. So she was a very important osprey in our lives. And then in 2013, a really big new female osprey arrived at that nest and kicked her out. She got pushed away and this younger bird took over. And we thought, well, that's her gone. Anyway, that year, the year before, we had satellite tagged her. And she went back to the same lake in Extremadura. And then in 2015, one of the keeper friends of mine said, there's ospreys back nesting in that other nest near Carr Bridge. And when we went with a telescope and looked, it was Green Jay. She was 25 years old and she reared another two young with a young male osprey from the borders. And she flew off in the autumn and we never saw her again. So she, there is an osprey, 25 years old. It's the oldest breeding female we've known.
Roy, what's it like for you? I mean, you saw them when, you know, they disappeared. And now, I mean, I had a conversation with a farmer in the summer. I said, oh, there's an osprey. And he gave me that look, oh, so what? You know, there's so many, you know, from nothing. It's just an incredible success story.
Yeah, but that's what people like me were after. We never believed that you should have to go to a rare reserve to see a rare bird. You know, the days when we could see ospreys flying over Inverness carrying a fish back to their nest, or people could sit in the pub down at Fintorn and watch the ospreys feeding in the water there, or a family take a picnic to a loch in the Highlands and an osprey comes along and fishes. That's how our birds should be. When they're rare, there's a problem. And the problems in the past with many of them were we killed them all. So the osprey has demonstrated that, you know, it is possible to bring things back and they become part of our nature that you see on your way to school or on your way to work.
There's quite a few ideas contained within your book that you kind of jumped out at me, not the least of which was one chapter on the pernicious effects of rarity. You're not keen on rarity. You would like things to be more common.
Oh, yeah. And I sometimes got into hot water because people think, oh, you're a birder, or you shouldn't be talking about mammals or plants or whatever. Why are flowers like some of the winter greens and twin flower, some of the mountain flowers, why are they so rare? And why don't we do something about it? Because often the rarity is because of the mismanagement of the land with excessive overgrazing or burning. And then you realise that a botanist in Scotland or a birdwatcher in Scotland has something very rare on his patch that he's very protective of. And then there's a guy in the South Downs has a very rare orchid. And so they say, if you come and see me, I'll show you my rare bird. And if you come to us, we'll show you this incredibly rare orchid. And my view is they should be much commoner. And I'm pleased that now there is a change. When I was in the board meeting at the Scottish Natural Heritage, I remember one time this came up and I said, we've just got to have more flowers so that children, when they're walking with their parents, can pick a bunch of wildflowers to take home. The idea that you tell children that flowers are so rare that they're not allowed to pick them is really appalling.
Much of the discussion about the state of various species is directly linked to the state of the habitat. And you write really enthusiastically about Romania. The chapter's called Days in a Real Forest, which says it all. I mean, describe that environment. What's a real forest?
Well, that was a very unusual venture. I was getting more and more interested in why we shouldn't have... We need the lynx back, and we need wild cattle, and we need the wolf, and we need the beaver, and all that sort of thing. And I read an article by a German biologist, and he was talking about wolves and bears and lynx in Romania, and one of his colleagues was talking about beavers. And I had to visit Germany to appear in court with a policeman from Inverness about a case of Germans stealing peregrines. So I got in touch with this guy and said, after the court case, I'd love to come and see you, and I did. And I spent 2 days with them. And they opened my eyes to how real kind of ecosystems work with these big mammals. And then the young guy, Christoph Promberger, moved to Romania and set up a research centre. And I went over to see him, and he took me around. He was trying to catch wolves for radio tracking. And we'd see the wolf prints, and we would see bears, and it was just fascinating. And I remember he took me one evening to a big hide overlooking a bear shooting area, because of course the brown bears in Romania are very common, because the old president Ceausescu was a maniacal shooter of bears. It was appalling, but he encouraged very high numbers. And we sat up in that hide as the evening drew in, and two bears came out and started to feed on maize that the keeper had put out. And through Christoph being able to talk Romanian, I was able to discuss ideas with Mosu, the gamekeeper. And I asked him, how many animals of different kinds were in his forest, which was about 13,000 hectares, kind of the large size of Abernethy Forest. And he said, we have 105 red deer, 120 roe deer, about 160 or more wild boar, There's 45 brown bears, there's 6 lynx, and there's 7 or 8 wolves. And I was just amazed. And then he said, do you have them? And I said, no, we've got rid of the lot. And an area the size of your forest would have about 2,000 red deer and 400 or 500 roe deer, and not a single large predator. And I remember looking at him and he smiled and he said, I could come over and shoot some for you. And that's when you realise that, of course, those animals were killed out in Scotland long ago. But we will have many problems in the future. You know, in my personal view, there are probably too many badgers, too many pine martens, possibly even too many otters for other species, killing off capercaillie and the like. And you need this control by the larger apex predators. And without that, it's going to be very difficult to make certain our ecosystems are working properly.
You have been fortunate enough over a long career to encounter umpteen figures who some of which are quite literally legends, like Frank Fraser Darling, the man who described the Highlands of Scotland as basically essentially a wet desert. What was he like?
He was a very interesting man. Of course, I met him when he was very old. But when he did all his very good work on grey seals and red deer, and he produced this incredible tome, the West Highland Survey, on the state of crofting and the state of the land and the state of ecology, that document definitely upset people in the Department of Agriculture at a high level. And they had it in for him. And he went off to work in America all his life. And that's where he did all his good work on how to restore range, how to stop destroying the agricultural and biological value of the land. But also before him, Professor Stevens was the same. He wrote early in the last century about the state of animal life in Scotland. And I'm a great believer that to be a good conservationist, you need to know your history.
You need to have a baseline in order to know where you stand at the moment. So where do we stand at the moment?
Well, the problem is the baselines keep moving. If you want to make things look good, then use a baseline of 1990. And other people use 1970. But if someone like me uses a baseline of 1950... then you suddenly look now and you realise the loss of flowers, the loss of insects, the loss of birds like yellowhammers and corncrakes. And sometimes it's difficult to recognise that although we've got, you know, more ospreys, more kites, what we've managed to restore are those that were killed, you know, in ancient times. So if you restore something because it was direct human persecution, the problem, then you can do that. But to restore these other things, which are to do with widespread flowers in the countryside, you know, the loss of bees and that, it's just really appalling. So we've got a lot of work to do. And, you know, I agree with Fraser Darling and others that we've got to restore the land. And that is the most essential thing we do.
That's also, in many respects, called rewilding, kind of different badge in a more modern environment. But a lot of folks see it in different ways. Many folk think it's, you know, bring back the lynx, bring back the bear, bring back the wolves. What does rewilding mean to you, or do you even like the term?
Rewilding is a new term. And sometimes, well, everyone gets rebranded. I don't think I've been rebranded, but, you know, recently Scottish Natural Heritage call themselves Nature Scot. I still think of them as the Nature Conservancy. So there is that kind of rebranding. But ecological restoration, restoring damaged lands, has been known for decades. But the importance of rewilding is that it gives a chance for a recharge. And the big recharge that has occurred in my lifetime, latter part of my lifetime, is that the ideas that we had in the 60s and 70s and 80s which were totally poo-pooed, you know, by politicians, by farmers, by all sorts, and landowners, have suddenly struck a chord. And there are more landowners now who are interested in rewilding and restoring their land than at any time in my lifetime. It's a time for great work in nature conservation and restoration of nature. And added to that is this significant alarm of young people. You know, anyone who's looking to the future, looking to what's it going to be like for our grandchildren's grandchildren, then we've got to change the way we do agriculture. We shouldn't have all these bare areas in the mountains solely for red grouse or sheep. We need a much more dispersed landscape, and woodland needs to be returned in a huge way. So that is more important than bringing back beavers and lynx, but it is essential we bring them back throughout the whole landscape.
Not everybody's going to be keen on that, though. I remember about 4 years ago, we were in Norway and talking to a farmer there, I mean, quite a big farmer, it has to be said, you know, who could, I mean, he didn't speak English, we don't speak Norwegian, so it was being done through translation. And his eyes just got rounder and rounder at the idea of us deliberately reintroducing lynx. He was very, very emphatic, and basically what he was saying was, you must be off your chumps. Why would you, I mean, he's a sheep farmer, why would you reintroduce lynx?
Well, I think this is where single interest groups can no longer dictate the wishes of the population. I think we have to work together in a caring and constructive way. But to say you can't bring back the lynx and that you have to jump through a million hoops to do so. And yet suddenly in my lifetime, all the fields became covered in yellow. Oilseed rape arrived and covered our landscape. I don't remember anyone asking us whether we wanted oilseed rape. Equally, suddenly, our traditional cows are replaced by charolais and all sorts of other things. Did anyone ask us about that? You know that I farmed and crofted, and I have strong links, and I love working with country people because I find them more sensible quite often than conservation people. But I've never believed in letting them get away with things that they shouldn't even be thinking about.
Well, what about sheep then? We've had sheep for 200 years. Nobody asked us for permission to have sheep. You've got a quote about big chunks of the forest were burnt. It was like clearing the Amazon rainforest to make way for sheep.
Yeah, it's very interesting because when the first big sheep being brought up from the borders arrived in Dingwall, it was the local crofters who wanted to turn them back. They didn't want the big sheep in the Highlands because they knew what was going to happen. Their friends and ancestors and relatives were going to be turfed off the land in place of the sheep. So the idea now that the sheep is like a god, and if a golden eagle should ever look at one, you know, it's appalling. These people's ancestors didn't want all these sheep here. And Fraser Darling was the person that said that when you have mixed agriculture and you've got cattle and the kind of ratio may be one cow to one sheep, the land remains in really good heart. But once you get rid of the cattle, you get rid of the rotational cropping and you rely solely on sheep because of the subsidies, the quality of the land goes down and down and down. And we've got to make a break. And I think that that's definitely going to come. The subsidies will not be there. The young people are not going to bother. They want another job. They don't want to. Most of them don't want to hang around in the hills doing sheep. And then less and less of us are eating meat. So things change. This is the time of restoring our world so that we can get through, you know, all the problems of climate breakdown and biodiversity crisis, you know, crash.
One of the things you wrote in your book made me smile, which was, and I think I'm quoting this correctly, that A cow will produce 7 tons of manure in a year, which in the old days was put straight back on the fields. So it was a sort of, you know, circular, quite literally a circular economy. As someone who has cleared out byres the old-fashioned way with a wheelbarrow and a shovel, I would contend it's probably more than that. But, you know, what I really admire about your writing is you draw no distinction between ospreys, goldcrests, what goes on in Romania, the farming. Everything is part and parcel of a much bigger picture. It all connects.
I think that's important. People have always, throughout my life, said, what is your favourite bird? And I've always said, no, I'm working on golden eagles at the moment, or I'm researching this, or I'm sending white-tailed eagles down to the Isle of Wight. But my interest is much broader. It's not individuals. I think the other value is that those of us in conservation in the early days often came from country backgrounds. You know, I lived in the countryside. We had pigs that we killed on a real little small holding. We had hens, we had turkeys, we had everything. So it was just normal for me, so that when I came to Fair Isle in 1959, it was not difficult to relate to how the Fair Islanders lived. I loved it. I loved the idea that you could drink milk straight from the cow. I loved it when the lady of the croft would put a thick coat of homemade butter on a scone made from razorbill eggs. Oh, how delightful.
See, that kind of thing is lovely, but you know, the fact that you had, the fact that you were a generalist, when you were working with organisations like Scottish Natural Heritage as a board member, and you're dealing with scientists who are becoming increasingly specific, to my mind, did that not cause tension?
Oh, often, yeah. But that was good fun. You know, I didn't hold it against people. I remember meetings in the time when grey seals were causing problems for fishermen. And we used to get quotes, if only it wasn't for the grey seals, your fish and chips would be cheaper. And then how can we get rid of these seals? So Nature Conservancy or Scottish Natural Heritage would come up with another draft for the government. And we were at one of these meetings and the scientist was there and I said, there's nothing about orcas in your paper. Why have you not got the major predator of seals in your paper? And I could see them all look around and think, oh God, where's Roy going now? Suddenly, in this last couple of decades, the major predator of seals is the orca. And those orcas, killer whales, are being seen, you know, the other day, the people standing outside Tesco's in Lerwick Harbour are watching a pod of orcas trying to grab a grey seal.
And did.
You know, marvellous.
The other thing, Roy, I remember interviewing you years and years, 30 years ago probably, for Landward, about the potential introduction of beavers. And you were really passionate about it. And I remember coming away, so what a great idea. He's not got a hope in heck of making that happen. And it did, but wading through bureaucracy must have been incredible.
It's been extremely difficult. What really shocks me now is that our government allows people to kill beavers in large numbers. And also that the alternative is to trap them, live trap them, and translocate them. And where are they going? They're going to England. Why can't they come to the Spey or come up into Western Highlands? There are loads of places that we need beavers in Scotland. Our plan should be now that the beaver should be restored to all waters. Everything that we said, that it slows the rivers down, it holds water for the summer, it prevents runoff, it traps chemicals, everything has been proved. And I know there's problems, but I don't think in the future you can grow potatoes and carrots within a few metres of a river. Growing crops and intensive agriculture close to watercourses cannot continue because of the runoff of agricultural chemicals into the rivers, estuaries and seas. It's just something, every river should have, you know, a 10, 15 metre belt of natural vegetation, a contribution to nature, to bees and flies and insects through flowers, and a safe place for beavers to eat without damaging agricultural crops.
You suggest in your book the possible establishing of a land ethics commission that would take a more holistic view of what we need, what we're being, rather than what we're being given.
I think so. And I've talked to my MSP, and my view is that this is a critical time in our future. And I don't think that the present bodies are reflecting the changes that we need. And there should be a group of probably elder statesmen with no ties to anybody who can look at some of this stuff and say, really, you should be looking at that or this. And they also involve in young people. I think the people that want to see change are the young, and the old, who don't have to worry anymore about their pensions or their reputations, are the ones more likely to give you honest opinions.
Roy, I was very much looking forward to speaking to you, and this has not disappointed. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak to us today.
It's been a pleasure. I've got loads more diaries and notebooks that I'm turning into books. And the next one comes out in March, which is called Restoring the Wild, about all the reintroductions I've done.
Well, hopefully by that stage, we might actually be able to do what we would have wanted to do in this case, and come and actually talk to you in person in your back garden or something. So
that would be good.
Roy, thank you very much. Roy Dennis's book, Cotton Grass Summer, is out now, and it's published by Saraband. Please get in touch with us and tell us where you listen to this podcast. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. We do like hearing from you. From myself, Ewan McElraith, producer Helen Needham, and of course Roy Dennis. Thanks very much for downloading this.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.